Board Game Bros.
Hello, everybody. We are the Board Game Bros. I am Matt Craig.
And I am Jeffrey Craig. Thank you for listening today to our beautiful podcast. Oh, by the way, if you didn't know, we're brothers in real life.
And board game designers in real life.
Yes, indeedy.
And this episode should be releasing on February 24th, and it marks the start of a new thing we're going to try to do with this podcast.
Yeah, so every last episode of the month, we decided we want to do an episode where instead of talking about one particular game, we talk about a more broad subject related to game design, and we drill into it and mm-hmm. get into the nitty-gritty of it.
Yep.
So rather than talking about one game for 40 minutes, we talk about many different games and something they all share in common, because that's the theme of the episode that we yep. want to talk about. And today's episode, we've got a pretty cool topic for you. Matthew, tell them what the topic is.
Yeah, so this is a mechanic that is pretty common nowadays. I think it started around like 2007, 2008, and it's really started to appear in so many different types of games nowadays.
Mm-hmm. A lot of mainstream games, I'd say, yes, are this mechanic. And a lot of mainstream pop cultural topics have been adapted with this mechanic in
yes,
board
it
games
is the,
and card games.
It is the 3D action platformer of board games.
Yes, it is the... yeah, from PS2.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that, pretty much.
This is, of course, deck building.
Yeah! All right, we're talking about deck building, the mechanic.
The game about building decks as part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to go out of my way right now to make a distinction that this is not the same as a game where you build a deck to play the game beforehand, i.e. trading card games or collectible card games.
Or limited card games.
Or living card games. Yeah. Anything like that, like Netrunner, Magic, whatever. This is not that.
Yeah, it's almost, this is more like the part that you do before that made into a fun game.
Yeah.
Instead of having to build a deck in order to play the game, the building of the deck is the game.
And we've already talked about one of these games on our show. It was the second episode we did on Dominion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because Dominion is, as far as everybody knows, the first example of a deck builder.
Mm-hmm. That was published in 2008.
I believe so.
By Donald X. Vaccarino.
Yep.
Yeah, or no, designed by Donald X. Vaccarino, yeah. Published by somebody else.
Yeah. Z-Man, I think.
Z-Man, right.
And that's still going. But of course, after Dominion came out, so many other deck builders started to come out. And I think it's kind of funny. You can almost tell when a deck builder was released based on what type of deck builder it is, or how it uses deck building in the game. Like, so to sort of give an example, so Dominion came out. A lot of the deck builders that came out shortly afterwards, around the same period, used a similar style in which there were some notable features
mm-hmm.
where in Dominion, you get cards that are predetermined which cards you can get at the start of the game. You shuffle them into your deck, and that's pretty much most of the game is drawing cards from your deck, playing them, shuffling the discard pile back in. Typical deck builder stuff. Afterwards, people started to add trade rows, which changed up the way that cards could be added to your deck and bought, which we'll get to that more in detail later.
Right.
And then the more recent deck building games use deck buildings more as a means rather than an end, where the deck building is used to facilitate some other mechanic like a board or building structures on a board, movement,
mm-hmm.
etc.
Right, so let's talk about, just in general, what a deck builder is.
Yes.
And I think it's fair to say that pretty much every deck builder, you start with a basic deck.
Yes.
And most of the game is spent adding to the deck.
Adding and removing.
Adding and occasionally removing.
Yeah.
And you're doing that because you're trying to make your deck better
mm-hmm.
at performing a certain task.
Yes.
So in games like Dominion, you're making your deck better at acquiring stronger cards.
Yes.
That's the primary focus, because you're trying to buy more expensive actions or more actions that you already have that you want to add more of because they're good. And then in the end, you're buying really expensive cards that provide you with a lot of points.
Yeah.
In Star Realms, another deck builder, the goal is to defeat your opponent by dealing damage to them.
Mm-hmm.
So in the deck building, you are building a deck that is better at defeating your opponent than your opponent's deck is at defeating you.
Yes.
And Star Realms, of course, was designed...
I want to say 2012 by White Wizard Games.
That's 2014 I have here. 2014.
Okay. Close enough.
Close enough.
And so there's that aspect. Of course, the cards that you get and add to your deck, the way you can choose them differs from game to game. Dominion, in a lot of the earlier games, would have a number of sort of universal cards that are always available no matter the rest of the board layout. In Dominion, this was the victory cards and the treasure cards, which are just base money.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other games, even, you know, now up to today, will have a sort of, like, this is slightly better money than the starting thing.
Star Realms has Explorers.
Yep. And Clank has cards that give you money and movement that you can get early on, so...
DC Deck Building has Agents, I want to say. Or not no. DC, Legendary.
Legendary has Agents. DC Deck Building, I believe, has Kicks, or something like that.
Yes.
So... there's usually that small general boost that isn't as powerful as an individual card, but is always there.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, in higher quantity.
Yeah.
And, yeah, as you said, always and then, available.
And then, so early games like Dominion, Thunderstone, I believe Nightfall did this. You, before each game, you choose a number of cards to be available during that game. And these cards tended to be in a single stack of, like, Dominion has 8 or 10 cards per stack, and players can buy whatever they can afford from those to put into their discard pile and then their deck, but once it runs out, it's out. Later on, in like DC Deck Builder and other Cryptozoic titles, and in Star Realms, a lot of games after that sort of early part period.
DC Deck Builder came out in 2012. That was designed by Matt Hira and Ben Stoll.
Mm-hmm. A lot of these games then added a trade row, where the trade row was a large deck of a lot of individual, slightly more powerful or more tuned cards that you could only buy so many of at any given time. Usually what this would be is there'd be like 5 or 6 cards from the top of the deck laid down face up next to the deck. And those are what you can buy. And then in these types of games...
as you buy them, they're replaced.
Yes, as you buy them, they're replaced with the next card from the top of the deck.
So you're sort of buying the top 4 cards of a deck.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shuffled random deck.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this randomness to what cards you're going to have available to add to your deck in these types of games.
These are sort of the main ways that these will appear in games. I know there's been a couple games, especially some that are coming up, like Dominion Nightfall, or no, Dominion Nocturne, the newest Dominion expansion, did this, where there will be stacks with different cards inside the same stack of cards.
Hmm.
So it's sort of a hybrid that allows the designer a bit more design space.
Okay.
But for the most part, these are the two main ways that getting cards appears.
So I'd like to dive into this mechanic right now with this topic. What does the mechanic do well in terms of gameplay? So these are the reasons why you would want to use a deck builder in your game design.
Yes.
So, and I'll start by saying that I think one thing that a deck builder does well is it has a tempo. Mm-hmm. It sets a tempo for the game, both like in gameplay and also in game knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So like you start with your basic deck, and your basic deck does all the basic things that the game should do. So in Clank, for example, the things that you do in the game are purchase guys and move around the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what your deck starts out doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the cards you add to your deck add complexity to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they you have to develop the strategy of the game in your mind when you're deciding which cards to buy. And then you're using that strategy as you play them.
Yes.
And as you play more and more cards, the tempo feels like it picks up because mm-hmm. since the cards are more complex, you're getting more things, more resources.
Right.
You're acquiring more things. You're doing more actions on your turn.
You're sort of increasingly complex and size, like sort of exponentially increased complexity over time,
mm-hmm.
which really helps new players get into your game.
Yeah, this is something that deck builders have over a limited card game, a living card game, a trading card game, mm-hmm. in that they remove the skill, or rather they take the skill required to build a strong deck, mm-hmm. and they stretch it out for an entire game, and everyone starts at the same place.
If anything, I would say it does a great job of limiting the amount of information you need to do before you play the game and maximizing the amount of learning you can do inside the game.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another thing that a deck builder has mechanically is randomness,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to board games,
mm-hmm.
Other than like dice in a board game. But it's like you never know. In a trade row, there you never know what you're going to be adding to the deck as mm-hmm. soon as you start playing. And then when you're playing the game, you never quite know what your hand is going to contain and what you're actually going to be able to do. You can predict it in some mm-hmm. ways, but there is a randomness. Randomness can be exciting. Mm-hmm. It can be real interesting. You know, you draw a hand and you're like, oh man, this is a bonkers hand. I'm so glad I drew it. Mm-hmm. This is so awesome. And also, it allows players who are less experienced at a game to still have chances to win the game
mm-hmm.
because of the randomness. There's an element that you can't control for, and that can be a good thing.
And personally, what I like about the randomness in deck builders is it is relatively mitigated in, like, as a designer, you can add however many or however few ways to sort of change or mitigate the luck in the game until you feel like it's comfortable for your game and your mechanics and everything, the feel you want for the game. Because obviously, even if you have a trade row and there's no way to remove or draw cards, the players are still the decider on what they add to their deck. I know this is more into like the player experience side, where as a player, I don't think it's very fun, unless the game is based around risk aversion or something like that, to have pure randomness be the downfall of you because you had no way to influence it or predict it slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And deck builders, by their definition, are about at least knowing what you're putting in your deck so you can, you know, bank on that.
Right, that's interesting. A deck builder has this randomness to it where you can have these weird crazy turns because you drew a bomb hand, or you can have some bad turns.
Mm-hmm.
But it also is almost all about mitigating that randomness to a certain degree, because mm-hmm. you can buy more cards that do the thing you want to do so that your deck is more saturated with the cards that you want to draw mm-hmm. and less saturated with the cards that you don't want to draw. And then there's also the ability to remove cards from your deck that a lot of deck builders have that really help you mitigate the randomness.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of has both,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting, which can it can lead to a lot of exciting moments, and it can lead to a lot of learning and understanding of deck building and of randomness. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, like, experienced deck builders know, is the whole mitigating randomness, you know, mm-hmm. like in a trading card game.
Deck thinning.
You want to have, yeah, you can thin the deck. You want to have as few cards in your deck as you are allowed mm-hmm. in deck building in like Magic the Gathering or Yu-Gi-Oh or whatever.
Yeah.
And you want to have more copies of the cards that you want to draw most frequently mm-hmm. and less copies of the other cards. But you don't want to have so few copies of a card that it's very improbable that you would draw it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that, yeah, that, and then a deck builder game will teach you that
and as you yeah, play it. It's a good thing because that sort of strategy of wanting multiples of good cards and less of bad cards is very apparent when a player plays through the game.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's their first deck builder, they'll buy that really powerful action or currency card, and when they draw it, they'll think, oh, I want another of these so I can play two in one sort of cycle of shuffling.
Mm-hmm. And you don't even have to really even consider that when you're designing a deck building mm-hmm. game. That's just sort of built into the deck builder yeah. right there, which is kind of a reason why you might want to use a deck builder
mm-hmm.
when designing a game, just to have that inherent player learning experience.
I think one big element of deck builders that is kind of hard for some other games to do elegantly is the aspect of time and having to like use an effect and then wait for it to come back, or having to sort of invest in an effect and wait till you can use it. This is an element that's really important in deck builders that a lot of games also try to do without decks or cards or whatever. I know, like, one good example I like of this is in Codex, which is a two-player competitive card game with some deck-building elements, where you're adding spells and upgrades and units to your deck as you go. It is done so to mimic both the cooldown of an ability in a video game and the time it takes to build a unit in, like, a real-time strategy game. And so, like, this idea of using a powerful effect, but then saying that you have to wait till it gets shuffled back, I think that's a really interesting balance decision, as well as a really interesting way, like I said, to port over a mechanic that would normally be automated in, like, a video game into a tabletop game form.
Right. Codex was designed by David Serlin, by the way.
Yep.
And I have the deluxe set, at least, came out in 2016.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that in other games that don't use a deck, you have to ask a player to track something every turn. And other than drawing a card each turn or drawing a hand of cards each turn, it's difficult for a player to have to remember to do something, to upkeep something. And so, like, if you have to track, like, this thing lasts for three turns, or you do this thing and then three turns later you can do it again, it's difficult.
Yeah.
And so, like, a deck builder, and having a deck at least, is an elegant way of doing that. And a deck builder, as your deck gets more complex, then the time between drawing a card gets extended.
Yeah, like in Magic, for example, there's a fair amount of mechanics that require using, like, counters or dice to keep track of a timer. But even then, players tend to forget when to remove or add to that counter. So they put a little reminder on top of their main deck to be, like, right when you draw, you're like, oh, wait, I have to do something. And I think that that's solved pretty nicely with deck builders in a way.
And, you know, it's kind of funny in a deck builder that this this extension of time between things can really only occur every X cards, depending on how many cards you draw for your hand. So if you have, I think the most common number would be like five. So every turn you draw five cards, you play whatever you want. And then the next turn you draw five new cards. So only until you buy five more cards has the turn the time between seeing a card each turn actually extended significantly for every card in your deck. So that maybe that's an interesting thing that a player might be able to track in their head, because it's just like five every five cards I've added now I got to wait a turn longer. In the case of when you want to buy new cards, maybe. So like you just take the number of cards you have in your deck divided by five, and that's how many copies of a card you should have if you want to be drawing it on each turn.
Right.
And then also it's kind of almost like it may not feel like it, but it's kind of like there's a spike every five cards. Like now your deck is much longer. It takes you that much longer to cycle through everything and put it back in your deck and then see it again.
Yeah. And I want to touch on the, like, cards drawn per turn size. It seems like it's not usually a definite number, but it's more based around half of the starting deck size. It seems that way because almost every deck builder I've played, you draw half your deck in the first turn, and then you draw half your deck the second turn, and then turn three you would be able to potentially draw any cards you had bought the first two turns.
Yeah, you're likely to draw it. That's a good point. And that's interesting because you can at least plan your first two turns after seeing that first hand.
Definitely.
To a degree. At least in like a game like Dominion, you know exactly what you're going to be able to buy.
Yeah.
And then in trade row games, you can at least look forward to having the money you have the turn after next, you know. Let's see. So what does the mechanic have going against it? So what are some things that you have to keep in mind when you're designing a deck building game? Or what are some reasons why you wouldn't want to use a deck building game? And we touched on randomness.
Mm-hmm.
We know that as much as the game is about being random, having exciting moments while when things are random, and then also learning how to mitigate the randomness and then doing just that and mitigating the randomness, there's still, even if you've mitigated the randomness as much as you possibly can, there's still possible turns in a deck building game mm-hmm. where you just do nothing. And that feels bad.
Mm-hmm. So the ones that immediately spring to mind, there is physical requirements in deck builders, namely being able to shuffle a deck and hold a hand of cards. That isn't something that I normally think about when designing a game, but there are definitely times where it might be worth it to consider, is this game accessible for people in such a way? For example, I wouldn't really recommend a game for kids being a deck builder, mm-hmm. because I know, personally, when I was a kid, not many kids knew how to shuffle a deck. The other one that I think is important to think about is actually budget. That it is really hard to make a budget-friendly deck builder, like, unless you already have a lot of funding to have a large print run, compared to a budget-friendly, like, abstract game. Only because a lot of deck builders need a pretty large amount of cards to actually be substantial. So, like, I mean, you can make a very cheap deck builder. Like, Star Realms, I think, is $20 retail usually.
That's one of the cheapest deck builders.
That's one of the cheapest, and it gets by on a very low amount of cards. And there's, like, there's a Press Your Luck deck builder called Flip City, which has even fewer cards, and I think it's closer to $15. But, like, it's a lot easier to make a game with fewer components, something like, you know, an abstract, like I said, like chess, or even like a deduction game like Werewolf.
Or even like a light card game like...
Right.
Like Flux.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like a game like that where... Because in a deck builder, you need a lot of cards. You need enough cards to make full decks for every player and then some, so yeah. that there's some variability to it.
And the fewer cards you have in the box is the lower replayability in the game.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah. Although, I to your first point, yeah, there's access mm-hmm. limitations for building a card game. But you do have to admit that playing with cards is pretty fun.
Yeah.
I think it's fun to, you know, hold a hand of cards.
And then play and a bunch of all them on the turn. Then,
yeah, yeah. Slam cards down on the table. If you're good at shuffling, then you like to shuffle cards because it's a good feeling.
Yeah.
Unless you have a particular, you're one of those people that doesn't like to bend your cards.
Yeah.
So you very carefully pile shuffle them.
Just get sleeves.
You don't riffle them. Sleeves, that's an interesting thing. That's yes, the other thing, yeah. Cards are, although they're getting stronger. They're getting stronger.
Overall.
Cards, they're getting stronger. You have to be looking out for those cards. Overall, yeah, there's some printing methods that can make some pretty strong cards. But yeah, cards aren't the most durable game pieces. You're better off with like wooden pieces or plastic pieces.
Or even, well, yeah, if you're talking about just any component, even like cardboard punch-outs.
Mm-hmm.
are more durable typically than cards themselves. And this also gets back to budget, that usually there's a number of different qualities of cardstock you can buy to like print on from a printing company. I believe the more common ones are like blue core, white core, and gray core. Obviously the more durable ones are more expensive, but that also means that if you are looking for a much more budget game, then, like, you might not want to do a card game because it might mean you have to go with the flimsiest cards to print it.
Yeah, and you can tell. You can really yeah. tell when a card has been printed on cheap cardstock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's flimsy in your hand. It feels like it'll crease easily if you mishandle it. And
you need a dehumidifier in your storage room or else it will curl slightly.
Yeah, and sometimes, like, they feel, like, chalky on yeah. the edges. You ever feel that?
Sometimes.
I feel that with a couple cards. There's also, I feel, there's an inherent complication with the order that you play cards in
mm-hmm.
that can come up with a new player. sometimes you can just make it a rule where it doesn't matter what cards you play in, mm-hmm. what order you play them in, but you still have to activate abilities in certain orders, like in Star Realms. Mm-hmm. You can play the cards in any order, and then you choose when to activate the ability and when to spend the resources. Mm-hmm. In Dominion, order of play is very important.
Definitely, because that has limited actions per turn.
So how you handle that can add or get it, there's a level of complexity to that no matter how you handle it. Mm-hmm. There's ways of handling it to make it less complex, but then when you do that, it might also change the way that the game is played. So if right. you if it's important that there's card order, then you know, then you're going to have a little bit of complexity there in your game.
I think the last point that I would warn against making a deck builder is if there's no good way to have, like, a basic set of cards. Because we talked about how important the starting deck is, usually, and how that's, like, a central part of deck builders at this point. I think if there's not a good way for a player to read the cards they have in their hand at the start of a game, like, at the start of their first time playing your game, and figure out what they do and play cards accordingly, it's going to be a lot harder to warrant making the rest of the game a deck builder around that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, Dominion, 7 of the starting cards give you money, and the other 3 don't do anything in your hand. Even Clank, it's very easy to tell what the starting cards do. They have just, like, 1 money or 1 movement on them.
And nothing else.
And nothing else.
Or +1 Clank, which is kind of like, mm-hmm. it's doing nothing and then doing something bad.
Yeah, but it's still a very small number, too.
Right, right. Yeah, okay, good points. So, mm-hmm. we touched on this a little bit earlier, but the method of acquiring cards and how they're presented provides interesting mm-hmm. design opportunities. And we talked about trade rows and card piles,
mm-hmm.
And what they do for the design of your game.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, you know, with card piles, like we discussed in Dominion, they allow everyone to see everything that's available,
mm-hmm.
plan advanced deck building strategies many turns ahead.
Sort of snipe your opponent's strategies if you don't know what they're doing.
Right.
By watching them do it and then being able to try it yourself.
It makes it easier to track what cards people are buying because mm-hmm. you can just look at a pile and notice that it's getting pretty small.
And
it's also a less, there's usually less variety of cards in, mm-hmm. in a pile game too, because you don't want to have way too many piles. So you right. typically have like 10 piles, and that's different from like a game where you can have 40 or 50 unique cards mm-hmm. in a trade row deck.
Yeah. There's less cards to remember like the names of and what they do in any given game.
Mm-hmm.
And in turn, pile based deck builders tend to be designed more around like, I want to say, like, individual efficiency, where, like, they warrant buying more copies of fewer cards just because you have the option of doing so. And, like I said, because of that, they're usually more, like, tuned in specific ways. I think it's better to compare that to trade row deck builders, where a lot of times in trade row deck builders, cards tend to be a little samey, but they're meant to synergize well with almost every other card that comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Pile deck builders tend to have cards that synergize well with a few things, or tend to be very efficient at one specific thing, but not good everywhere else. Like, they're more tuned, whereas the cards in trade row deck builders are more general. So that's sort of a design concept to think of.
Right. And then there's also that in trade row deck builders, you have to sort of decide how many cards in the trade row appear.
Right.
How do they get replaced? I thought there's a game called Cthulhu Realms. That's kind of interesting because, let's see, Cthulhu Realms was it was published in 2015, designed by Darwin Castle. Mm-hmm. That one had 4 trade rows, and each trade row sat between 2 players. There was a trade row sat between each player.
Mm-hmm.
And so you always had access to only 2 of the numerous trade rows in the game. So, and each trade row had 3 cards each.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting way of having the trade row, but not have everyone sniping from the same one.
That is another thing I wanted to talk about. So, Dominion got a lot of flack when it first came out for having limited player interaction. Trade Bro deck builders do tend to lend themselves better to player interaction because you can directly counter an opponent from buying a card.
Mm-hmm.
In Dominion, there is pile control, meaning like, you know, trying to keep your opponent off of the cards they want for their strategy or getting to them first. But usually that's either just buying cards before your opponent does, or like making them have to pay more money or get bad cards when they buy the card. But in Trade Row deck builders, I think every single one I've seen has a way to just remove cards from the trade row outright.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that has risk elements where like, if you remove a card that's good for them, they might get another card that's good for them. But at that point, it is just risk aversion and typical, you know, luck factors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, weighing your how much is a benefit to get rid of this card versus how much is a benefit to leave it there.
Now, I found that in a trade row game, it's harder to catch up than in a pile deck mm-hmm. building game. Because in a trade row game, you know, in any deck building game, many deck building games, typically mm-hmm. the goal is that you have your deck produces resources to acquire cards and defeat your opponent, and the more you build your deck, the better it becomes at producing these resources. And so because you're better at producing resources, you're better at, you can acquire the better mm-hmm. cards for your deck. And in a trade row, then, you know, you only have access to so many cards. And so if you're able to pull ahead by getting access first to the good cards, then that means you're going to get access quicker to the even better cards, and you're going to be taking them off the board before your opponent can catch up enough to be mm-hmm. able to take them off the trade row themselves.
Yeah, I would say trade row deck builders tend to be more swingy, which I think that can be fine if your like target audience is like newer players, or I think that's why they lend themselves so well to licensed properties, because it can attract fans of whatever property, like a show or a movie, without them having to already be really into deck builders to really care about the strategy behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can still win and have a good time and have, like I said, a chance of winning, even if they're not big into it, you know, but they'll play it because they enjoy the property.
Mm-hmm. It's also kind of cool in a trade row deck builder to have the really big splashy cards come down out of the trade row deck.
Yeah.
And being like, whoa, that's a really good card. That's actually a cool gameplay moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if nobody's too far ahead, then it becomes like a race to get that really cool, powerful card.
And that is worth bringing up, that like, if you want to make these cool moments that last with the players, you know, it's like when you flip over that 8 cost card that's like draw 4 cards when you play it,
and gain,
you can almost hear a chorus of angels coming from above in a ray of light shining on the card,
because mm-hmm.
everybody's immediately drawn to it.
Mm-hmm. And this sort of gets into the common mechanic of like of card acquisition, card mm-hmm. cost. When you're designing a deck builder, you're kind of designing a limited card game in that you have to balance cards based on what they do and how much they cost.
Oh, definitely.
So how can a deck builder be used flavorfully?
Flavorfully?
Yeah, what is the flavor reasons why you might want to use a deck builder? And I think...
So we already talked about the cooldowns for, like, if you're trying to make a game that's sort of like a video game.
Mm-hmm. So, Sentinels? Well, it is
Sentinels of the Multiverse isn't a deck builder, but it has that reshuffling deck.
Yes. I guess you could call DC deck building is like that, because a lot of your cards are like a hero attacks, mm-hmm. like Laser Eyes or whatever, or any other Cryptozoic deck building game.
Yeah, and like I mentioned, Codex is directly supposed to be like a port of a real-time strategy game like Warcraft
mm-hmm.
to card game form. And in that case, it uses the deck as, like I said earlier, cooldowns and unit building times.
Mm-hmm. There's so, also the progression of the game that mm-hmm. you start very basic and then you get much mm-hmm. stronger and larger. Star Realms uses the flavor that you are adding ships to a fleet.
Yeah.
And you're using those ships to defeat and acquire more ships and then mm-hmm. eventually directly attack your opponent's fleet of ships.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting in, like, Dominion, the flavor is just, it takes time to build buildings and structures around your kingdom. But then, since that game also puts a much larger emphasis on getting rid of bad cards, It's also kind of funny because removing cards is almost like being a king and choosing which person in your village gets executed, or like choosing where to demolish
demolish
your market so you can build a giant laboratory something.
Where does the highway go? Yeah. You know, you evict people.
Yeah.
You bulldoze over an estate because you have to put a castle there or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Ascension is about amassing a group of adventurers and defeating more and more difficult monsters. So that's kind of in the same vein as Star Realms, where you start with a basic squad and you're improving it. Same with Legendary. Hold on, let me go back real quick and say that Ascension was published in 2010 and designed by John Fiorio and Justin Gary.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have Marvel. I'm going to pull that up. Keep talking.
Yeah, so there's, like, the character progression and, like, fleet progression. It's almost like an alternative to a typical, like, character sheet or character inventory, like maybe Munchkin. Or in the case of amassing, like, a fleet or an army, it's almost like an alternative to a game with a lot of miniatures or units or pawns. Which... Right. It's also very space effective for that too, which is a nice bonus.
Mm-hmm. And maybe cost effective as opposed to like very, very intricate plastic miniatures or something like that. Marvel Legendary was published in 2012, designed by Devin Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
Building civilization, army, fleet, skill set, many reasons, flavorfully to use a deck builder.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of any flavorful reasons why you would use a trade row rather than trade piles?
I think a good one would be just sort of like encounters in a way.
Yeah.
So I think this is why it makes sense for Ascension and Star Realms and even Clank, is because in those games it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense if you could like plan out what you're doing ahead and be like, I know I want to do this. It's a game where it's themed about going around a universe or a world and picking up whatever you can along the way to help you.
Right.
Whereas, like, Dominion, you are a king who would obviously have a planner or an advisor or somebody to actually show them the blueprints and all the options available.
Right. I do like Ascension, especially because it's about, like, slaying monsters, and so these are, like, wandering monsters coming in. And in Clank, they actually are encounters because they have, like, the boss element where...
Yeah.
And Legendary does this too, where they have, like, the boss element where when this card is drawn, now you have to do this special thing because this random trade row deck has interspersed within it these events that could be detrimental to you.
I think Legendary also has a really flavorful use of its mechanics with the villains.
Yeah.
Where they
the
have...
trade row for the villains isn't like other trade rows.
Yeah, it's like a meter where they start on one side of the trade row, but you only have one at the start usually.
And then as you add more.
Yeah, as you add more, the one that's on the that, you know, was earliest there moves along. And it's sort of like a first in, last out way, where if a card gets pushed off the trade row, it's gone and usually has a penalty. So in that case, it's used both as a mechanic for adding some urgency to the villains, but also flavorfully, it makes sense. Like, if villains are attacking New York, you need to stop them immediately.
Yeah, and it starts in the prison, and then the sewers,
and then like the bridge.
And then the bridge, and then the downtown area, and then they're gone. Yeah, and it's kind of the villains, attacking the city and then escaping. Mm-hmm. I like that. And I like the idea of shuffling into the trade row deck cards that don't go in the trade row, like they do in Legendary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a thing you can do, is that mix in, and that's kind of to the cooldown effect, to the randomness effect, to the trying to predict, you know, it's been a while since I've seen a card that will affect me negatively, so maybe I should hold off. Maybe I should just buy those cards that you always have access to in order to save up and gear up for something like that. So how can, last topic, how can a deck builder be used in conjunction with other mechanics?
In conjunction with other mechanics,
The obvious combination, but probably the most difficult to actually develop, is card building, like they do in Mystic Veil.
Mystic Veil, the card building element is almost just a advancement of deck building. Like, the idea that you're not just building a deck, but you're building cards in a deck, it adds another element of cutting corners and removing fluff and adding better stuff, because you can actually upgrade your starting cards that way, which I think is cool. One of the more prominent ones that we tend to see is deck builders where the cards are used to interact with a large board or map. I know one of the more early deck building games, Trains, was sort of like a train railroad building version of a deck builder, where the cards you add are made for the purpose of usually either adding cards to your deck or building railroads across a map. But then, you know, we've been talking about Clank, where a lot of the cards you add can impact the way you move around the board.
Yeah.
Open up new routes.
Yeah, they provide you with a number of spaces of movement. They provide you with ways of bypassing certain barriers, like enemies on the board, rather than enemies in the trade row.
Another popular one that we haven't mentioned before is Tyrants of the Underdark. It's a Dungeons & Dragons licensed deck builder released in 2017. That is about using your cards to make make pawns and units on a board, and then move those units across a map of the Underdark to like rule it as the reigning noble.
So it's kind of like a turn-based strategy game.
It's like a
map domination game.
Well, it's like if Risk had a deck builder.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like Risk, but it uses the deck builder like for cooldowns and specialization.
Yeah, as a way that would make sense to like add, you know, advisors or just more forces to your fleet.
And an easy way of incorporating this into a deck building game is just by making the cards in the deck building game both produce resources that help you acquire more cards and also produce resources that interact outside of the game. So you might acquire a resource that you can spend on cards, or you can acquire a resource that you can spend on moving, or that you can spend on producing figures on a map.
Yeah.
Or stuff and like that.
This sort of mechanic does a lot of good things for the game. Like, it makes your game stand out more, which is great. It makes it so that you have more design space, but in a good way. Sort of like, you have more room to work with and make new effects for, and sort of make the game its own. Really expand on your basic mechanics. Another benefit of it, I just thought of it, is that it makes it so that the cards don't feel the same to the players. You know, you can have cards that are like, this is a really good war card or a really good movement card, but it doesn't do great for resources. Oh, and this actually helps a lot with the one other topic I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
If you're okay with moving on to
it. Sure.
So, in card games, mainly trading card games or competitive card games, there's an idea of a good stuff deck. This is the reason that I think exists for, like, why Magic has colors and, like, Netrunner has factions and Yu-Gi-Oh! Has archetypes.
Yeah, deck building limitations, almost.
Yes, because theoretically, if a player could play all the good cards with no restriction and no reason to specialize in any good area, it would tend to homogenize sort of the gameplay in the meta. Now, trade row deck builders, so they tend to have factions. Like, Star Realms has, like, machines and blobs and the Federation or whatever. And Clank had, like, scientists and prisoners or rebels and, like, lone wolves or whatever.
Marvel had specific superheroes.
Yeah, with, like, the specific types, like, energy or strength or whatever.
DC deck building had card types, like, equipment
and
enemies and heroes. Well,
so that's one way that trade row deck builders do this. Usually the cards don't require those sort of tribal synergies. Tribal being just, like, a notable term for, like, a themed synergy that pre-exists.
A faction.
Yeah. They don't require those, but it gives you a good bonus that helps you. It helps you if you take the time to specialize, but it's not required. But in turn, trade row deck builders tend to keep the game from homogenizing just by randomizing what cards are available anyways. In as far as other, like, sort of good stuffs go, Dominion doesn't do this too well, because there is a chance that you could just play the best cards on the board, but the best cards are the best by a certain margin.
I will say that with factions, it is a like a roadmap for mm-hmm. a new player, in that you see factions, yeah. and now you want to add factions together. And as long as some of the faction cards tell you how, in what ways, putting factions together will make their cards better, mm-hmm. then you have the idea that you should do that. And also, a faction will always have a unified strategy of playing the game. Mm-hmm. And yeah. so it, instead of having, like in Dominion, where you have to figure out how the desperate parts work together, mm-hmm. the parts are already working together if you're buying cards all the yeah. same faction.
It's pretty beginner-friendly in that it's like a build-around guideline. From a flavor standpoint, I love factions or stuff like that because it lets you play around a lot with just the meaning of mechanics. Like, I mean, I could go on for hours about Magic, but the designers of Magic already do that.
Mm-hmm. We could talk about Star Realms.
Yeah, like Star
about
Realms.
About how the robot factions are good at trashing things.
Yeah, they're good at getting rid of the materials they don't need and using what's left to make better robots.
And that's kind of a robotic, like discard yeah,
like
and
a,
stuff. You have no
like
sympathy.
A Skynet Borg sort of thing.
Yeah, you have no sympathy for the weak robots. You want to get rid of those eventually and replace Assimilate. Them with much stronger robots.
Yeah, that's like a typical sci-fi thing.
And then the blobs... It just apparently value strength because they deal the most damage.
And they're a lot better in multiples. They have the most, like, tribal synergies, I think.
Yeah, and then there's also...
The blue, like, Federation has healing, so that makes more sense because they're supposed to be, like, the commerce, peace-loving, like, sort of good guys, quote-unquote.
Yeah.
And so since they're more humanitarian, they would, you know, heal and give you more money.
And the yellow guys have a lot of a discard.
Mm-hmm. They're the most warlike of, like, the human factions.
Mm-hmm.
But they're more about disrupting with, like, skill.
Yeah, rather than... They don't try to defeat you with
pure
brute
strength.
Force.
Yeah.
They beat you with value.
They outmaneuver you.
Right, right.
But, like, even so, if there's no factions or there's no reason to put in factions, I think that's a better time to have, like, action limits like Dominion. Because it's also, like, if you could buy every good card and play all of the cards in your hand, then that's different than being able to buy all the good cards and only play one or two every turn. As far as balance goes and just making sure, like, you can't have one player who does a ton of powerful stuff and one player who doesn't do much except for maybe one thing, I think that warrants more of, like, that hard cap on how many cards you can play per turn then.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thought.
It's just a straight-up way to limit how many good cards you can play a turn.
Right. Thinking about if you can play good cards, mm-hmm. you know, then what's... You know, obviously there's the barrier to acquiring a
yeah.
good card, but once you have it, should there be a barrier to having to play the good card?
Yeah, it's like, what's the value that a player has in trying to specialize their deck or build around a faction or even, you know, really dig deep into the game's mechanics?
Mm-hmm.
And even then, like, DC Deck Builder and the other Cryptozoic stuff, they have, like, characters or identities that you use, that you start off with. So, like, you know, you can be Batman, and Batman likes equipment cards. Mm-hmm. And that's another way, or another reason for players to not go as general and specialize more.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say that with factions, mm-hmm. it prevents... two people from doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Because if you're both buying up one faction, like, you can, but you're going to be competing constantly
mm-hmm.
when if you pivot your strategy to a different faction, then you can build more built-in synergy. So
yeah.
that's an interesting thing that prevents the homogeneity of...
Yeah, that's another thing yeah. is if you're, like, trying to make a competitive game or even just a game that's fun to play multiple times, it's a good idea to try to want to have different viable strategies that can win in their own right, but that also are worth different players playing in the same game. That's a good way. That's also why I brought up having, like, the board or whatever, is because it's a good way to prevent that sort of good stuff thing by making good cards that specialize in one of the unique areas. And then, like, sort of encouraging players to be like, all right, you should... you know, focus more on this because that's something you can do to win that the other player's not doing. And then the other player is able to focus on their other thing they can win with that the first player isn't doing.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's yeah. a super special, extra long episode of Board Game Bros. Thanks for listening,
yeah.
everybody.
I do want to make some shout outs to some deck builders.
Okay. Shout outs.
So, one thing we didn't talk about, since we talked about quite a lot already, is so there are some games right now that have variant starting decks per player. The big one being Hero Realms, which came out 2016, I want to say, and is sort of like the sequel to Star Realms in terms of its just like mechanics. It's like the spiritual successor. The other one is actually a video game that is a deck builder, but it is so good. I've been playing it so much, and it's because it just, it scratches all my itches for a good strategy deck builder I can dig deep into.
Really quick, which is, by the way, Hero Realms was designed by Robert Doherty and Darwin Castle.
Oh, okay.
All right, and what's the name of the video game?
Slay the Spire. Chances are, if you've been on Twitch lately, you've seen it on the main page, but it's a very good game. It's in early access right now. It started in like 2017, late last year.
That was designed by Mega Crit Games.
Yeah, and it's a really good deck builder, and it's also a good example of how, like, not just board game design, but how these sort of things can relate to video games, and sort of how video games can do things board games can't do, because Slay the Spire has a lot of mechanics that would only work as a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's good when you're thinking about board games and video games, either one, to think about what makes this special for its medium over another medium.
Mm-hmm. We didn't mention this game, but this is a game that uses deck building as sort of a secondary mechanic to the larger picture, which is about collecting resources and trading resources.
Oh, yeah.
And that's Concordia.
Yeah.
That was published in 2013 and designed by Matt Gertz.
A good, fun game about trading in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, that's a really fun game. I like Concordia. And we mentioned Clank and Cthulhu Realms. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Bunch of fun stuff.
Bunch of fun stuff. So again, thanks for listening.
Yep.
Extra special long episode. If you want to, you can follow us on iTunes or on Google Play or on Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. We have social media accounts where we try to post regularly. We have Twitter
and Facebook,
and both of those are at BGBrosCast.
Yep.
We have a website. Matthew, what's the website?
www.bgbcast.com.
Don't forget those W's, guys, because you
https://https://? I don't know.
Probably.
That's an important question.
Well, I hope Wix uses the S.
Yeah.
We have a sister podcast in a way. That's our friend's podcast called Entertain the Geeky. That's our friends Robert and Chris that talk about
Roger and Chris.
Roger and Chris. They talk about nerd culture, nerd news, everything.
They do have their nerd news podcast, which is run by our friend Jason.
Yep. You can find all that stuff at entertainthegeeky.com. That's also where you can find our published games. Right now, we only have one. It's a one-page role-playing game called
Merle's Truck Stop in Maine.
It's got a cool, freaky Halloween theme, which is perfect for the month of February.
Mm-hmm.
It only costs $1, and all the money we earn from that is going to publishing our very next game, which we are very excited to tell you about.
Whenever we get the chance.
Whenever we get the chance. We hope it's real soon. I can feel it. I can feel it coming. It's going to be real soon. And we're really excited to share it with you.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
Not that I can think of.
All right. Thank you for listening, everyone. Stay tuned for next week, where we get back to talking about actual games.
We should have a new first of the month episode on, I believe it's Friday, is March 1st.
Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah.
New first of the month, BGB Good Stuffs.
Yep.
And then a new episode about a board game.
Woo!
Look forward to it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening.